Rolf has been feeding him premium grain and the sweetest hay. As you can see, Miss Bunchberry said, we've observed proper etiquette. Letitia wouldn't have us dine in the kitchen, though Bay and I normally sup there. What fun it is to see Mother's old table in use once again. From time to time, relatives or my father's old colleagues would descend upon Seven Chimneys. Letitia would cook and bake all day in anticipation. Those were grand times. Goose and sauce were passed around, along with the last of the winter squash, legumes, mushrooms, and dressing. A slice of warm bread spread with creamy honey butter melted in Kerrigan's mouth. It was like a traditional midwinter feast, except it was spring. Miss Bayberry poured Roven red wine in each goblet, and Kerrigan could only guess at the vintage. It was like spending an evening with a pair of spinster aunts, eccentric as they were, but oozing comfort and a sense of home. The canny intensity Kerrigan had witnessed before seemed to dissipate as the evening wore on and the wine bottle made its rounds. When they had eaten all they could, they removed to the parlor, where glasses of brandy awaited them, and the fire roared in the hearth as cheerfully as ever. Kerrigan sank into the sofa with the hummingbirds carved on the armrests, her goblet in one hand, and she told tales of her mostly silly classmates and Selium. Bunch and Bay raised eyebrows upon learning that the hot springs could be pumped directly into a bathtub. "It was so long ago that we lived in Selium," Miss Bayberry said. "I don't think half the school or museum buildings you described were there when we were. Otherwise, the city hasn't changed much." She swirled her brandy in her goblet and smiled in a self-satisfied way. "Child, you have enlivened this house more in one day than we have been able to in years. My sister and I will remember your visit for some time to come. I can only hope that you have found your stay with us equally interesting." Kerrigan nodded emphatically. Interesting was an understatement. "Miss Bunch tells me you spent the afternoon in the library. What did you think?"
"It was unusual." Miss Bayberry cast a severe glance at her sister.
"Bunch, did you just leave her there? Did you explain nothing? Give no forewarning? But Father's old things are so harmless." "That is not the point. We caused our guest undue surprise. That was not proper."
Miss Bunchberry gazed sulkily at her lap.
"The moonstone lit at her touch."
Her voice was nearly a whisper. Miss Bayberry scrutinized Kerrigan anew, and something of that hidden intensity reignited. And it wasn't just the glow of the wine or brandy.
"My dear child, that stone has shown no light for many a year. How you called upon the moonbeam to glow, I can only wonder. Do you have any idea?"
Kerrigan shook her head, wary. "No, I was just curious about the objects on the table. And when I picked up the crystal, it lit up." She wondered if she had somehow offended Miss Bay, but the old woman's expression was glad.
"What else did you observe?"
Kerrigan described her experiences with the bottled ship and the harp. "They were very odd." She shuddered, remembering the tempest she had caused. "I mean, they possessed qualities that were so real. I know it's illusion." Her statement was met with lingering silence. "It was illusion, wasn't it?" Miss Bayberry leaned forward and, evading the question, asked, "What else did you observe?" Kerrigan licked her lips, a little nervous now. "Well, the harp sounded so human, unlike the lap harps my friend Estral plays, and she has access to the finest instruments in all of Selium."
"My dear child, arcane objects are unusual. Of course, when you first observed the things on my father's table, they seemed relatively normal. After handling them a bit, you discovered otherwise. The bottle, the moonstone, and the harp are a few among several devices Father collected over the years in order to comprehend magic. He discovered, like you, that arcane objects can take on some very lifelike qualities. That harp has a very dark history. It was originally made by the finest craftsmen of the turn of the First Age for a wealthy aristocrat. It was carved as no other instruments of those times, and inlaid with precious jewels, themselves cut by masters of lost Cymarn, for whom rocks and gems were living things. The aristocrat was pleased by what he saw, but not with what he heard. When strung, the instrument sounded like any other well-crafted harp. The aristocrat, it seems, could not live with a harp that was not extraordinary. Remember now, this was a dark time. Magic was more accessible and understood back then. Mournhaven the Black was at the height of his power, and dark magic had a profound influence on many people. It was difficult to wield any magic without the taint of the dark. So strong was Mournhaven.
Miss Bayberry paused to take a sip of brandy. She carefully replaced her goblet on the table before her, clasped her hands, and bent toward Kerrigan to resume her story.
It's not known if the aristocrat had innate powers himself, or if another did the work for him. But he had the finest singers known in the lands, including Elysians, who have the fairest voices of all, brought to his keep. Using methods unknown today, he extracted the voices from the singers and melded them into magical strings. Child, what you heard were voices from centuries ago.
Kerrigan remembered, with clarity, the crystalline voices of the strings, strains of some ancient past forcibly carried into the future, like ghosts. What happened to the singers? Miss Bayberry tilted her head, looking beyond Kerrigan, a sadness in her eyes.
There is no record, but you can believe that if they survived the process, they lived without that which they loved most, their ability to sing.
The more Kerrigan learned about magic, the less she liked it. It seemed to bring nothing but evil and grief. The telescope.
Oh! Miss Bunchberry groaned. Not the telescope. I do think, my dear Bay, that we should remove the lenses and crush them beneath our heels.
Nonsense, sister. That telescope was one of Father's most treasured pieces. Tell me, child, did you see far when you looked through the eyepiece?
Kerrigan noted there was no question of whether or not she had gazed into it. I saw very far, too far. She described the series of images as they had appeared.
A sprinkling of the past, present, and future, declared Miss Bayberry. Such a device could erode one's sanity if one had constant access to it. Father possessed a tremendous will to resist using it when he had major decisions to make. Believe me, he felt the lure, but he also felt it was human temptation, more than the device itself that called to him. Indeed, no one should see too much of their own history or future.
Miss Bayberry fixed her piercing blue eyes on Kerrigan.
Remember, child, your future isn't made of stone. What the telescope showed you was what may happen if the present line of events continue.
Put that way, it sounded to Kerrigan as if the current of her life was out of her control. It wasn't a welcome idea. Do you look into the telescope? The sisters seemed to know so much about everything.
Heavens no, Miss Bayberry said.
We've no need, Miss Bunchberry added.
The ladies would say no more about the telescope or anything else in the library. Miss Bunch left the parlor briefly and returned bearing a wooden game board and multicolored pieces. She set them on the table before them.
Are you familiar with intrigue, child?
Kerrigan had recognized the game immediately. It was all the rage in Selium. Two kingdoms battled for dominance, each piece possessing a different ability. Arranging the pieces in various patterns created offenses or defenses. The pieces, in this case, were made of ivory or bone, dyed in the traditional colors of red, green, and blue, and carved in the likenesses of kings, messengers, spies, soldiers, and so on. The game was most difficult when played as a triad, with a third player who was random, the wild card, with no set loyalties one way or the other. The other two players could petition the triad for allegiance, but the triad could choose not to take sides and play for its own benefit. It was the never knowing of what the triad player would do that made intrigue exciting. Exciting, if you liked the game. Kerrigan didn't. She lost every time she played. I've played intrigue a few times, but not often with a triad. Estrel had been her only friend at Selium. There was never a third person to play with. Miss Bunchberry clapped her hands.
Splendid! Bay and I haven't played with the triad in a long time either. Child, you will be the triad, and if this first game doesn't last long, we can switch.
Splendid. Kerrigan remembered to smile, and because propriety was so important to the ladies, she said, I'm honored.
That's good. I offered to a guest first, as was proper.
Miss Bayberry nodded in solemn agreement. They played long into the night, each taking a turn as triad. The gentle sisters transformed into ruthless opponents, and Kerrigan found herself, as usual, on the defensive. Miss Bay took a general and three of her knights. Miss Bunch killed her queen and abducted a spy. She watched their pieces march across the star-shaped board and annihilate her kingdom. And she wondered, with a bemused expression, if she and Estrel had been too kind to one another. The sisters did not spare an inch, where Estrel would have allowed a concession. Kerrigan didn't consider herself a ruthless person. Rather, she considered herself wise to the ways of survival. The swordplay tricks the cargo master had taught her, the stories her father had told her of his perils and adventures as a merchant traveling in far-off lands, her experiences far away from home among aristocrats. These were basic learning experiences for life. She had never thought of employing ruthless tactics in a harmless game of intrigue. When the third and final round was won by Miss Bunchberry, the older woman sank back into the sofa with an ecstatic giggle.
That was just so fine! I could play endless games! But I know it's late.
As if to accent her words, the last embers of the fire crashed in the fireplace, sending a flurry of sparks up the chimney. Miss Bayberry's lips were set in a taut, straight line. She had won two of the three victories, yet she seemed none too happy about it.
I think the child wasn't putting her all into the game. Perhaps she believed she was doing the polite thing by letting us win.
Kerrigan blushed, as she often did, somehow feeling guilty.
I did try. Tsk, not hard enough. You've much intelligence for such a youngster. Use it. Many of the situations you come across in intrigue aren't too far removed from real life. Many of the aristocrats use it as a teaching tool for their children, and it may have been developed for that exact purpose.
Miss Bunchberry looked scandalized by her sister's outburst.
Bay, you really oughtn't criticize our guest.
Miss Bayberry rolled her eyes in annoyance.
Bunch, sometimes one must go beyond the bounds of propriety and speak her mind.
She jabbed her cane at Kerrigan.
Child, use your brain. Think on your feet. Being polite and reserved is how we were raised, but we learned the hard way that the rest of the world isn't that way. I've perceived from conversation that you comprehend such things, like that sword play with, what's it, that titmouse or whatever his name was. In other words, child, propriety has its place, but don't let your guard down. In real life, you never know who the players of intrigue really are, or what they stand for.
The words echoed in Kerrigan's mind as she followed Miss Bunchberry and the glow of the oil lamp up the stairs to the second story. Weren't Miss Bayberry's words much like what Arms Master Rendell had told her one evening after sword practice as she repaired fighting gear at the field house?
Do not make the mistake you made with tea, Miss Lass,
he had said, pipe smoke curling above his head and up to the rafters of the field house.
Never assume the enemy is down, and then turn your back on him. You will pay for it with your life.
In other words, expect others to play dirty. Miss Bayberry's words and Arms Master Rendell's hung heavy with her, but every time she thought of Temus as Titmouse, she was reduced to giggles.
This is the East Gable guest room, Miss Bunchberry said. You will see the sun rise from here, and the morning sun will fill your room with warmth.
She lit another lamp for Kerrigan's use.
Letitia has aired the place out and put fresh water in the pitcher next to the wash basin. She will draw a hot bath for you in the morning as well.
If I could see your Letitia, I'd thank her for her delicious cooking and all the details she has seen to. Carrigan thought it rather odd she had seen no signs of servants, especially the often talked about Letitia.
We will pass your praise on to her, if she hasn't heard already. Now,
Carrigan put a hand on Miss Bunch's wrist before she could go on. Why can't I meet Letitia? Miss Bunch brushed a gray curl from her face and looked at Carrigan in surprise.
You want to know why you can't meet Letitia? Isn't knowing that she is here to serve enough?
No. In my clan, the servants are practically part of the family. It only seems fair to thank Letitia in person.
Miss Bunch clucked her tongue. Dear, dear, she muttered.
But when she saw Kerrigan's look of resolve, she said,
We are not fond of relating painful stories, child, especially when one's father is at fault. It was an accident.
An accident? Kerrigan's brows drew together in a perplexed line. What was an accident? Miss Bunch's eyes shifted, and she plucked nervously at the hem of her apron.
Letitia's invisibility was an accident. Oh, dear.
Miss Bunch drooped into a chair as if overcome. Carrigan's mouth hung open, aghast.
Invisible? Very invisible. Far beyond what you are able to attain with your brooch, child. Completely, irreversibly, transparently invisible. She is more akin to an energy or a ghostly presence, for we cannot hear her either. But we know she's there, for the house is tidied when neither my sister nor I have lifted a hand. Our meals are prepared for us, and so on. We know when she is less than happy, for she starts sweeping up a tumult like a great dusty tempest. And it's not just Letitia.
Not just Letitia? Carrigan looked all around her, wondering how many invisible servants might be in her room this very minute. It made her skin crawl.
Well, there's Rolf, the stable boy, and Farnham, the groundskeeper, too.
And you said they are invisible by accident? Miss Bunch nodded mournfully.
Indeed, child. You see, Letitia was forever nagging father. He tired of her pointing out the mud he tracked in from the garden, or the coating of magic dust he left in the library, which she had to wipe up. He was consumed by his scholarship and scraping off candle wax from tabletops or leaving papers in orderly piles were not foremost in his mind. One day, as father was in the library hard at work, studying some form of magic or another, Letitia stood in the doorway with her hands on her hips.
At it again, eh, Professor? She said. A spill of that vile liquid in yon beaker will ruin the finish of your fine table, and then where would we be? And after Herschel, we finished it for you last month.
Who's Herschel? Carrigan asked.
Herschel was our handyman. Was with the family for 100 years, it seems. We believe he has passed on. Things break now and then, and no one fixes them.
Miss Bunch emitted a sad sigh.
If he were lying dead somewhere, there was no way for us to see him.
She paused for a few moments, then continued her story.
Letitia nagged at father until he commanded her to silence. I need quiet, woman, he said, not your endless nattering. Letitia is not one to just sit quietly while the chaos of clutter, dust, and bubbling fluids threaten to overwhelm her sense of domestic orderliness. But she had pressed him too far this time. Sir, she said, waving her dust rag in emphasis like a law reader about to present some crucial evidence to an arbiter. May I remind you that you threatened the sanitary concerns of this household, and you with two little daughters under your roof. She followed up that reproof with a tisk, tisk, tisk.
And that's when it happened. It, Carrigan asked. Miss Bunch fanned her face with her hand.
Yes, it. She tisked one too many times, and father lost his patience. Remember now, their run-ins had been going on for a very long time, and the tension between them both had built up over the years. Father shouted,
Servants should not be seen or heard. Well, that did it. We haven't seen or heard any of the servants ever since. Not one of them. But we know they're there.
Wait, Kerrigan held up her hand. Your father said that servants should not be seen or heard, and Letitia and the others just disappeared?
Well, no, child. Dear me, but I don't tell stories as well as Bay. I left out one crucial fact. The vile liquid Letitia feared that would ruin the finish of Father's table was volatile with spells. The spells responded to his command unequivocally. He could not countermand it.
Kerrigan was aghast. And the servants stayed with you even after your father turned them invisible. Weren't they angry?
Of course they were upset, child, and terribly so. But they stayed in hopes that Father would find another spell to reverse the curse. He searched to exhaustion and illness to find one, and never stopped until he died. He was terribly remorseful, and I think the servants knew it. And yes, they stay on with us. Where else can they find positions, invisible as they are?
And so, that's it? Kerrigan said. Letitia and the rest will be invisible to the end of their days? Miss Bunch nodded with a solemn expression on her face.
We try to treat them as well as possible, and continue Father's search for a cure. We have picked up a thing or two about magic along the way, but so far nothing that will help the servants. Alas, there may not be an answer.
Kerrigan had no response this time, and Miss Bunch pulled herself out of the chair and patted her on the shoulder.
As I said, it is a painful story, one that we will never be free of. In the meantime, we go on, as we must, and, she added in a whisper, we take care about what we say about whom. You never know who is listening in.
Miss Bunch moved to the doorway.
If you need anything, just call. I sleep down the hall. Bay can't negotiate the stairs very well lately, poor dear, so she has taken a back room downstairs. Sleep well. Breakfast will be served when you wake.
Kerrigan was left alone in the room, which, like all the others in the house, was well appointed. A porcelain pitcher and bowl stood on a washstand. The heavy bureau, carved intricately with pine boughs and cones, was draped with hand-embroidered linens. A huge cedar chest, full of coarse wool blankets, sat at the foot of the bed. A pieced quilt with a diamond-shaped motif flared like a starburst. She looked in satisfaction at her clean clothes neatly folded on the edge of the bed. She took the winged horse brooch from her robe pocket and pinned it to the lapel of the now spotless greatcoat. She checked the greatcoat for the love letter and found it intact and undamaged. Miraculously, or perhaps meticulously, the vigilant Letitia had removed it during the cleaning process and replaced it after. The message satchel, too, had been placed on the bed. She hadn't dared to open the leather case before, and though she felt the sisters could be trusted, she did so now. Inside was an envelope sealed with the wax imprint of a winged horse. All items accounted for, she could now sleep in peace. But then she caught sight of herself in the dresser mirror. Her image was like a ghost flowing by, her long white nightgown billowing behind her, gauzy and luminous. She backed a few steps to gaze in the mirror. She found herself mostly unchanged from her travels, if a little thinner in the cheeks. There was a blemish beneath her left eye. She leaned toward the silver glass for a closer look. It wasn't a blemish exactly, but a reddened, crescent-shaped scratch just above the cheekbone and just below her eye. She remembered the image of Imerez through the telescope and the feel of his cold metal hook against her cheek. She touched trembling fingers to the mark and turned away from the mirror. It was coincidence and nothing more. She could have gotten the scratch from thrashing through the underbrush or from her own fingernail. She could have gotten it from anywhere. Exhaustion was leading her to strange fancies, and she delayed going to bed no more. The bed was like the one her grandmother had used. It was so high that a stool was stashed beneath to help one climb into it. Kerrigan sank into the down mattress and clutched the blankets about her. It was hard to believe she had been with the sisters for only a day. This afternoon, she had been asleep on a patch of moss, not even sure how she had gotten there. Tonight, she lay in true luxury between crisp, cool sheets, smelling as fresh as if they'd just been pulled off the line. She blew out the lamp on the nightstand and sighed in satisfaction. It had been a strange day, but there was nothing extraordinary about this gabled room or the comfortable feather bed. Kerrigan nestled under the covers. The house was draped in silence, but outside, peepers cheeped in their springtime chant. The last sound she heard as she drifted into a heavy slumber was the hoo-hoo-hooing of an owl in a tree below her window. In the morning, the horse waited outside for Kerrigan. She had awakened to the warm glow of the rising sun, as Miss Bunchberry had promised she would, certain that she had slept hours upon hours. Yet the sun was still low when she finally roused herself. Even when she took her time bathing and breakfasting on the elusive Letitia's cooking, the morning advanced very little. Time seemed, well, flexible at Seven Chimneys. She had slept in and taken her time in every endeavor, and yet she was still getting on with her travels bright and early. The horse was tacked, the saddlebags bulging to capacity. His chestnut coat glowed in the sun. Someone, probably the invisible Rolf, had given him a bath and thorough brushing, and he looked handsome, despite his gangly shape. Kerrigan gave him a companionable slap on the neck.
"Before you go, child," Miss Bayberry said from the front step, "we've a few things for you."
Kerrigan glanced at the bulging saddlebags and felt the extra weight in her pack. "You've already given me so much, all the food and a change of clothes."
"Nonsense, child. Those are just provisions. You have a little growing to do, and Bunch and I are concerned about your proper nourishment. We would like to give you some gifts, very simple gifts."
She held forth a tiny sprig with dark green leaves.
"My namesake, Bayberry. When you find resolve failing you, when hope is lost, or you miss the deep sense of wild places, take a leaf and rub it between your fingers. The scent will refresh you, and perhaps you will think of me."
Kerrigan smiled as she took the bayberry. The freshly cut branch was fragrant. Miss Bunchberry had a shy smile on her face. She held in her palm a flower with four white petals.
"Bunchberry is my namesake. There's a small patch in the woods behind the house, just pushing up out of the ground with the spring. If you are in need of a friend, pluck a petal from the flower and let it drift in the wind. Perhaps you will also think of me. It won't wither soon, child, as good friendship should not."
"One more thing, child," Miss Bayberry said.
She pressed something cool and smooth into Kerrigan's hand. Thin slivers of light beamed through her fingers, even in the bright sunshine.
"The moonstone!"
Kerrigan cried in awe.
"I can't take this. It was your father's."
"Don't be silly," Miss Bayberry said. "It has taken to you. I dare say it never lights up for Bunch or me. And as for it being father's, well, I'm sure he would have wanted you to keep it."
Miss Bunchberry nodded in agreement.
"Take it. It will light your way and keep you warm. It was the moonstones, they say, that held back the dark forces during the Long War. It should serve you well. May the moon shine brightly on your path."
"Thank you. Thank you."
Kerrigan's eyes grew moist. "Is there anything I can do for you? Take word of you to Kin in Sacker City."
"My! But she's taken to the part of being a messenger, hasn't she, Bay?"
"Definitely. But I'm afraid that we have no kin in Sackle City. Just a cousin down south, and you wouldn't want to meet her."
"Miss Poppy is very cranky," Miss Bunchberry said.
"And that doesn't even begin to describe her. Child, you need do nothing for us, for you've done so much by giving us a little company. And as I mentioned before, Green Riders assisted our father in his search for knowledge. We are simply returning the favor. If you are back this way, do visit. Just watch out for brigands and thieves on the road."
Kerrigan didn't think the sisters had gotten the better end of the deal. But this wasn't one of her father's bargaining sessions. She looked the manor house over, at the windows reflecting the woods, at the chimneys puffing smoke.
"Why," she asked, "do you call this place Seven Chimneys?"
"You mean when there are more than seven chimneys?"
Miss Bunch asked. Kerrigan nodded.
"Why, seven is a magical number. Nine is not. And Father wouldn't use a name for his home that wasn't magical."
Kerrigan chuckled and mounted the horse. "I don't even know how to get to Sacca City from here."
"East by north, child,"
Miss Bayberry said.
"East by north will get you there."
When it was apparent no further information was forthcoming, Kerrigan reluctantly turned the horse down the road. Glancing once over her shoulder, she saw the two sisters standing side by side as they watched her leave. She waved, and they waved back. She wished with a sigh she could linger. All too soon, Seven Chimneys and the sisters disappeared behind a bend in the road, and shortly after, the road turned into a deer trail. She reined the horse around, but found that the road was really gone, as if it had never existed. She circled around in the underbrush, but could find no evidence of it.
"A road can't just vanish," she muttered.
But then again, neither could a girl and a horse. Merwell. Thomastine II, governor of Merwell Province, sank wearily into his worn, hide-upholstered armchair, facing a stone hearth large enough to walk into. The fire would do his bones good. It would relieve his joints of aches accumulated over an active lifetime of hunting and warring.
"Blast the cold damp," he thought.
The great arms of Merwell, two warhammers crossed over a mountain crazed with cracks and fissures, on a field of scarlet, drew one's eye above the massive mantle. The creation of the arms, according to the family chronicles, coincided with the formation of the Sacker clans before the Long War. Clan Merwell's ancient roots were imbued with crushing opponents, of possessing the strength to strike down the very mountains. The Merwells had never governed their province with the bejeweled scepter of gold, but with an iron hammer of war. Even so, over the generations, the province had grown quiet, almost sleepy. 200 years ago, however, it had not been that way. The clans had torn at each other's throats for land and the glory of the family. Clan Merwell had absorbed more land into its borders than it had lost, and acquired a reputation for savage brutality. Ah, the glory, when you knew what a man thought, and he expressed it with his blade, instead of today's spineless politicking of court eunuchs who stabbed you from behind with words. The High King of old was no more than a clan lord himself, sitting on a pretty throne, watching all his liege lords, the clan chiefs, gut each other. The clan chiefs had eminent control over their lands and all those who lived within their borders. Once a year, in the rare display of peace, the chiefs swore their fealty to crown and country, paid their taxes to the realm, and that was that. Although the chiefs of Merwell were often the close confidants of the kings and served as advisors. Then King Agati's Sealander, the last of his line with no heirs born to him, died of old age, and Clan Chief Smithy Hillander of Clan Hillander ascended the throne. That's when history went awry. Merwell combed his fingers through his lank, gray hair. Yes, everything changed with Clan Hillander. King Smithy tamed the lands with his own forces, created permanent boundaries, and decried bloodshed between clans. He proclaimed the clan chiefs brothers and sisters, and said that the country of Sacaridia could never survive if it did not stand as one. There were other ways, he said, than bloodshed to find glory. Indeed, the clans had never seen such unity since the Long War. King Smithy said the founding clans of Sacaridia, when they created a High King, had never intended the chaos beset by the Sealander line. Merwell snorted. King Smithy pacified the clans. The chief of Clan Merwell had fought the new way, but the king's soldiers had come to him, and Clan Merwell was pacified too. Merwell's soldiery had been decimated or run into the Telegmar Hills, until they surrendered. The honor of the clan had never been clean since. King Smithy bestowed the clan chiefs with new titles. They became Lord Governors, and new industry was encouraged. Commerce blossomed as timber was harvested and granite quarried. Eventually, the papermaking process was discovered, and the printing press invented. King Smithy even encouraged good relations with neighboring Rovni, and trade developed among lesser clans whose merchant fleets plied coastal waters, elevating Sakaridia's reputation as one of the wealthiest countries on the continent. The old High King was called the Great Peacemaker, and Province Day was established as a national holiday celebrated throughout the country in the summer to commemorate Sakaridia's unity and the man whose words were carved into his tomb in Sakar City. They read, "There is greatness with unity. Only if we lift ourselves above our base and bestial natures shall we stand as one." The fire hissed and steamed with rain that seeped down the chimney, and Merwell shook his head. The raging blood of his clan had never been truly gentled. Tournaments and hunting diverted some of the bloodlust, but there wasn't the same glory to be had. Oh, there were occasional forays into the Underkingdoms. Merwell had been on a few himself. But even now, ties had been forged with those savages, and there was nothing. Nothing. Until now. The governor was determined to raise his clan to its former glory, to once again attain a place in concert with Sakaridia's kings, to expand forth its boundaries that now felt too crowded. He would control commerce and the distribution of wealth, and he would do it the old way, by force. Merwell sighed, glancing at the crumpled letter on his lap, sealed with the dean's mark. Before shaking the very foundations of Sakaridia, he would first have to deal with his son, his only progeny despite a succession of wives and mistresses. Actually, he would deal with his son second. Someone was here to see him.
"Report."
Captain Imerez stepped into the flickering light. It gleamed off his bald head. He had spent no small amount of time waiting for his lord's notice. Merwell was perfectly aware of this. Imerez's face remained neutral, however, and his bow was deferential, despite the misery his wet, muddy uniform must have caused him. Imerez was young yet. He could stand it. The youngsters could traipse through the wilderness in all weather conditions, none the worse for wear. Merwell had paid his dues in that way. The bear head mounted on the wall attested to his strength in the old days, and he was now content to manage his province by his fireside and let the young ones do the work, just as his father had before him.
"My lord governor,"
the captain said,
"we've killed the messenger."
"Good."
The captain could always be depended on to carry out his directives. He had been hand-picked from hundreds of young soldiers years ago to help in raising Merwell province back to glory.
"And what did you find out about a spy?"
Imerez shifted uncomfortably. His one eye darted to and fro, and he licked his lips. Rain pattered against the window.
"We were unable to extract that information before he died."
"What? I don't find that satisfactory."
Imerez held his chin up.
"The only way to stop him was to kill him."
Merwell drummed his fingers on the armrest of his chair, which was carved in the likeness of a catamount's head and rubbed smooth by the years.
"Meanwhile, someone may be loose within my household, imparting information of my plans to the king. Where's the message?"
Imerez swallowed.
"Well, man, what is it?"
"The message, it got away."
"The message got away? What did it do? Sprout legs and run?"
"Yes, my lord. No, my lord."
Merwell rubbed his grizzled eyebrows with his thumb and forefinger.
"Explain." "We chased Coble Bay for days, and even more after we injured him. The day we thought we finally had him, he eluded us yet again. He rode like a demon, as if his horse had wings. Unnatural, if you take my meaning. He should have died days earlier. He rode off the trail and into the woods. We lost all trace of him, as if he'd disappeared completely."
"How do you know he's dead?"
"We found him eventually, on the Selium Road." "So where's the message?"
The governor's voice was tinged with impatience.
"With the horse."
Before the governor could bark another question, Imerez explained,
"Someone took the horse.
That fool Thursgad thought Kobol Bay's ghost still directed it, but we caught up with the rider cloaked in a greeny greatcoat, and very much of the flesh. This rider did vanish.
Greeny tricks, eh? I've heard they have uncanny abilities, but they are close-mouthed about it. Zachary keeps that woman by his throne, you know the one.
Mapstone?
That's the one, Mapstone.
He snarled her name.
He keeps her by his side, and she looks at me like she can see right into my soul. I heard of greeny magic when I was a boy, and I always knew to keep my mind clear around her. And my words, honest, no sense in taking a chance, and I'm glad I haven't. Only a greeny could disappear like that. What do you plan now?
Imerez released a long breath, as if relieved by the governor's apparent understanding.
My men and the Grey One continue to track this new greeny. I request additional help. I thought it would prove advantageous if we include a couple of Prince Hamilton's people in the chase. After all, it is for him we are treading such a dangerous path.
A couple of Hamilton's folk, eh? Which ones did you have in mind?
His weapons.
Merwell chortled.
How very shrewd of you, Captain. We'll make our would-be king feel a little vulnerable without them, eh? And how very appropriate. They are already traitors to the realm, so by necessity, they will be careful. By all means, broaden the search.
What if the prince should protest?
Does he have any choice? Without our help, he won't be able to claim the crown as his.
The fire popped, and the captain blinked. Merwell ran his fingers through his beard, where four white streaks cut through the gray like claw marks.
You must stop that greeny, Captain. We must prevent that message from getting through. If it does, our plans could fall to ruin, and the reprisal would be harsh indeed. We mustn't alert Zachary to his impending assassination. Find out also who the spy is, if one exists, by whatever means necessary.
Yes, my lord.
Imerez started to bow, but Merwell stopped him with a gesture.
And Imerez, if you fail, I shall carve out your other eye from its socket myself, and display it in a jar on my mantle until it withers away.
Imerez's cheeks blanched. He knew it was no casual threat. He completed the bow and turned smartly on his heel, leaving the library in brisk, even steps. Merwell chuckled. Imerez was generally a competent man, but a threat wouldn't hurt. It was no secret the governor could have housed a museum of body parts taken from those who had displeased him. The letter from Dean Geyer crinkled as he unfolded it for another read-through. His idiot of a son had lost a sword fight with some merchant girl and had retaliated by involving the Selium Merwells. It seemed his cousins had things under control. The girl in question was suspended from school for the fight, causing her to run away. Merwell, never fond of merchants, grinned. Maybe his boy held some promise after all. But governing a great province, a province that was destined to become even greater once they rid Sacaridia of King Zachary, took more than simple retaliation and meanness of spirit. The girl's name was Gladion, a name of the old days, but not an original Sacker clan, and certainly the name of a lesser clan, a merchant clan. He had heard of it before, he thought, but it was one that did not frequent Merwell province. He rang the bell at his side, and presently his aide, Major Beryl Spencer, joined him. Her bow was crisp, but elegant. Ah, if he were only 20 years younger, maybe the two of them could have bred a robust, intelligent son. But he had grown too crusty, and another heir now would not only ruin all his hard work with Temus, but would complicate things inordinately. My lord, Beryl perched on the edge of a chair and held a quill and paper ready to record his command or to script a letter.
I've an assignment for you, Spence, he said, using his pet nickname for her. My son has gotten into trouble with a girl of a lesser clan.
Shall I offer the clan reparation on your behalf, or shall we acknowledge the child?
Child? What? Oh, no, not that kind of trouble.
It was an amusing thought that made him chuckle and almost erupt into a belly laugh. Beryl's perplexed expression prolonged it.
No, I doubt the runt is capable of siring a child. I'd like you to find out about a merchant clan called Gladian. Find out who they are and what their home province is. I want to know how powerful they are, should they seek retaliation.
Yes, my lord. Anything else?
Send word to Dean Gaia that I need dates, not just names. I thought the man to be intelligent, as scholars are supposed to be.
Beryl's eyes were questioning.
In regard to...
He'll know what it's about. And tell our messenger he must reply immediately. Dismissed, Major.
Yes, my lord. Beryl bowed and left him. An efficient woman, that Beryl. Mirwell liked to surround himself with efficiency. Efficiency meant competence, and competence meant that his goals would be achieved. He had but to command. He glanced at Dean Geyer's letter again. There was a natural history class full of high-blooded children at Selium, some of them the sons and daughters of clan chiefs. Interesting that the Gladian girl's name should be on the class list. In an odd way, Temis had saved her life by causing her to run away. The field trip sanctioned by the dean would ensure that none of the aristocratic children would pose a threat to Prince Hamilton's ascension to the throne. Oh, there were others out there, thick-blooded aristocrats ready to take the throne, but they would be dealt with individually if necessary. Children were but a small sacrifice for a greater cause. Mirwell wadded up the letter and tossed it into the fire. He watched the paper ignite and blacken around the edges, seeming to fold into itself until it was no longer there. This plan of his had to be thought through, and he had been thinking about it for decades. Only with the help of the Grey One had it seemed possible for it to become reality. Beside his chair, a little table held an intrigue board, set with blue, green, and red pieces. Few were moved from their starting positions on the edges of the board, for only one man played this game. Mirwell removed a green messenger from the perimeter of the Red Court. The pieces were ancient, at least very old, and made of enameled lead. The features on the pieces had been blurred by the fingers of generations of his family. He laid the green messenger on its side.
"You are dead," he said.
Then he moved another green messenger into the fray. He positioned three red soldiers, two red knights, and a blue assassin behind it. Spawn of Canmaran Vane. Several days passed, punctuated only by the occasional spring shower. Kerrigan and the horse drifted between the north road and the cover of the endless forest, backtracking several times in hopes of confusing Imerez and his men, should they pick up on her trail again. Every so often, she felt as if she were being watched and was seized by an unnerving urge to glance repeatedly over her shoulder. But she never saw any evidence of pursuit, and the horse didn't seem concerned at all. Could it be that the spirit of Freyan Kobolbay still followed? At midday, she sat on a rock while chewing on a piece of dried meat. The horse wandered nearby, cropping at grass that grew in the road and swishing his tail at flies. Kerrigan slapped at her own neck. The biters had emerged in abundance after all the wet weather. After only a few days on the road since her stay at Seven Chimneys, she missed all the little comforts provided by the Barry sisters. The soft bed, hot tea, fragrant baths, and especially the conversation. It had been all very civilized. She kept the gifts bestowed upon her by the sisters close to her. The moonstone remained in her trouser pocket, and the bayberry sprig and bunchberry flower were tucked in an inner pocket of the greatcoat. Whenever she removed them, they were uncrushed and unwilted, and yet she wasn't surprised. The horse nickered and looked toward the sky, blades of grass sticking out of the corners of his mouth. Kerrigan followed his gaze, shielding her eyes against the glare of the sun. Far above, an enormous eagle circled. His size and dull coloring indicated he was one of the rare gray eagles who lived in the Wingsong Mountains. They were seldom seen so far from their mountain realm, and never at close range. Her natural history instructor, Master Ione, would give up his master's knot to see what she now watched.
The eagle rode the currents, rising higher and seeming to float on the air, then swooped lower as though watching something. Kerrigan could imagine the feathers on his wings rippling, and the wind roaring in his ears. What breathtaking sights he must see from so high up. Could he see beyond the expanse of the green cloak to the sea? Could he see the spires of his own mountain peak home? The eagle's circle widened. He was definitely searching for something. Prey, most likely. He hovered for a moment, as if frozen in time, before veering southward and out of sight. The horse snorted and resumed his grazing. At dusk, they followed a deer trail to find a campsite for the night. Kerrigan winced at the thought of sleeping on the ground again, certain that her back would never be the same after so many nights of rocks and roots. Her precious, albeit bedraggled blanket from Selium helped, but it was certainly no featherbed. Biters buzzed in her ears. It was feeding time, and they chewed on any bit of flesh she left uncovered. The horse shook his whole body to relieve himself, and almost dislodged Kerrigan from the saddle in the process. She scratched at a new row of welts on the back of her neck, wishing for a jar of prittle cream obtained from the horrible-smelling prittle plant, more often called stinky weed. Despite the pungent odor, or because of it, it was by far the best repellent against biters. Wishes were as solid as air, however, and she was no more likely to come across a pot of prittle cream as she was to sleep in a feather bed. Without warning, the horse stopped dead in his tracks and laid back his ears. Kerrigan paused her scratching.
"What's wrong?" she whispered. "I don't see anything."
There were any number of things in the deepening shadows of the woods that could spook a horse, though this horse was not easily spooked. Kerrigan waited for a moment, and when she didn't hear or see anything, she urged him forward. He resisted and stepped backward instead.
"I still don't see..." Off to their right, the underbrush rustled. "Anything."
The last word crept out in a whisper. Kerrigan's eyes darted from shadow to shadow, searching for the source of the noise, but silence hung thick in the woods, as if all the creatures within waited with bated breath for something to happen. The reins became slimy in her sweaty hands. The horse shifted uneasily beneath her. Just when she decided she must have imagined the noise, a creature larger than her horse exploded from the underbrush, scattering leaves and branches into the air, and hurled itself at them in a silvery streak. The horse reared, dumping Kerrigan out of the saddle. Kerrigan groaned. The whole world moved and bumped in her head, her aching, groggy head. The greatcoat and her shirt were bunched up beneath her shoulders, and the ground scraped and dug into her bare back. There was a terrible pain in her ankle. Her arms trailed behind her in the forest litter, trailing, moving, bumping. No, the movement wasn't in her head at all. Her foot must be caught in a stirrup, and the horse was dragging her. Her eyes fluttered open, and she had to crane her neck to see. A huge pincer-like claw, not a stirrup, clamped her ankle. The claw was attached to a saucer-shaped body, armored by a metallic carapace, supported by six jointed legs, a flat tail arched over the creature's body, a stinger oozing with venom the size of a dagger protruding from its end. Two black orbs glinted in the moonlight, moving on the end of eye stalks. A mandible worked where its mouth was, and two slender antennae felt the path ahead as the creature ambled crab-like deeper into the woods. A second claw snapped at the horse, forcing him to keep his distance. Kerrigan almost lost consciousness again, but she fought it off. Oblivion, no matter how inviting, was not going to help her. Instead, she screamed. Then, like a frightened animal snared in a trap, she squirmed and thrashed and snarled, but the claw held her fast, and in fact tightened and cut into her ankle. She moaned with the pain. She sat up even as she was being dragged and tried to loosen the giant claw with her hands. The shell was as hard as a knight's plate armor, and the claw wouldn't budge. Her toes began to feel numb. She fell back, puffing from the exertion, letting her hands trail in the leaf litter. Her head throbbed so, and she felt as though she might vomit. Where was the creature taking her?
"Gods," She stifled a helpless sob, her breathing ragged, her heart thumped against her ribcage.
Calm down, calm down, think.
She forced herself to take deeper, longer breaths, to relax her muscles as much as possible, just as Arms Master Rendell had trained her.
Caving into fear will be your death,
he once said.
There is no room for it on the battlefield. Being afraid is healthy, but fear is an enemy.
She continued with the breaths and thought about how she could help herself. Her head bounced on a rock and sparks of light burst before her eyes. She groaned and felt the back of her skull. She winced as she touched one egg-sized bump from when she fell off the horse, she guessed, and a small one from the rock. Rocks and roots continued to scrape her back as she was dragged along. Would this nightmare never end? How could she help herself? Her hand trailed along another rock, and she fumbled with it, but she couldn't get it firmly into her grasp. She searched for other rocks, but they were too small to have any effect, or too lodged in the ground, or too big for her to handle. She grappled with another that seemed right, and almost lost it when she ripped a fingernail on it, but she didn't give up till it was firmly in her hands. It was not easy to aim, being hauled along the ground on her back as she was. Using the strength of both arms, she heaved the rock at the creature, issuing a grunt as she released it. It glanced harmlessly off the creature's carapace and dropped to the ground with a thud. She succeeded only in drawing the creature's attention to her. It swiveled its disc body about to look at her directly. The eye stalks bobbed above her. Then the feelers swung over and probed her midsection.
Stop it!
Kerrigan cried. The jabbing was painful, and at times ticklish. She grabbed one of the feelers, and the other whisked away. It was rough and cold in her hand, and as thick as a broom handle. The creature considered her for a moment, then shook her till she was certain her foot would be severed from her ankle. She dropped the antenna, tears of pain slipping down her cheeks. The horse took advantage of the diversion and met the creature head-on, rearing up and pounding his hooves onto the hard shell. He moved deftly out of the way of the stinger to evade the snap of the claw. When he came too close to the creature's eyes, it was alarmed enough to drop Kerrigan's foot and pay full attention to the annoying mammal that threatened it. How astonishing, Kerrigan thought, that the horse hadn't run off, much less had stuck around to defend her. A moment passed before she realized she was free and that her foot was still attached to her body. She tried to stand on it, but fell back to the ground with a cry. Too much feeling flooded into her foot all at once. She stood up again, this time hopping on her left foot, and not daring to put weight on the right.
Horse!
The horse was too preoccupied with fighting for his own life to help. The creature, unburdened of Kerrigan, moved quickly from side to side and swiveled to stop him. The horse's hooves thudded the ground as he turned and swerved, bucking at the creature, then rounding on it and snapping his teeth. His efforts could have killed a man or woman, but proved futile against the armor plating of the creature. He was showing signs of exhaustion, his breathing labored and foamy sweat dripping on the ground, and he stumbled with increasing frequency. Kerrigan hopped away in an attempt to keep ahead of the two combatants. If the horse failed, there was nothing to stop the creature from getting her. She hopped and loped heedlessly, pushing through underbrush and checking over her shoulder to see how the horse fared. As the moon fell behind some clouds, an almost palpable darkness took hold of the forest, and she could discern little about her. Maybe the blow to her head contributed in some way by darkening the edges of her vision. With her uncertain footing and dim sight, she stumbled into something sticky, like a giant cobweb. She tried to walk out of it, but it clung to her and snapped her back, entangling both legs and most of her body. She struggled, but the stuff only stuck to her more.
What is this?
The moon began to edge out from behind the cloud, and she saw a white, web-like filament stuck to her arm and legs. In fact, it was tautly woven between several trees.
Oh, gods, a giant spiderweb!
Her only hope now was the horse. Something quivered down the length of the web. The moon had moved far enough out from behind the cloud to penetrate some of the deep shadows with light, revealing other creatures trapped like Kerrigan. A doe kicked, trying to free herself. It looked like she had been at it for some time. Her head sagged in exhaustion,
and her body heaved in staggered breaths. Birds, squirrels, bats, a raccoon, and even a wolf were ensnared.